We are in a summer sermon series called Summer in the National Parks, or at least we're supposed to be in that sermon series. But one small problem, I'm not sure if I've actually ever been to a national park. So for those of you that love hiking, I'm so sorry. For those of you that get me, I'm glad you understand. But we're going to hijack this a little bit, and we're going to change this into summer in the theme parks. So the roller coaster fanatics, you guys will be pleased for this. At one point in time, we took a trip to Busch Gardens in Virginia and rode this ride called the Loch Ness Monster. And yes, as you can see, they give you free previews with a big padlock in the middle of your photo. And then you have the option to pay $30 to remove the padlock. I did not do that. So I have a photo with a padlock in front, but this is us avoiding the Loch Ness Monster. In SeaWorld, there's a ride named Kraken, and SeaWorld is a little bit smarter, apparently, than Busch Gardens, because they did not give you a free preview with a padlock to be able to look at your photo on the ride. But today, we're going to talk a little bit about the Kraken, and about a variety of sea monsters and sea creatures that show up throughout the scripture. So if you don't know anything about the Kraken, I did some research because I didn't know too much about it either. The first allusion to the Kraken is in about the 13th century. There's an Icelandic writing, it's called the Saga of Eröad. Such a bizarre name, I don't understand it. But it speaks of two sea monsters that are just large, about the size of cities, and they're just like floating little islands. And these sea monsters just kind of float along around the surface. And when sailors would come past them, they would mistake these what appear to be islands for land. They would drop anchor, and they would get off the ship. They would go ashore. They'd build a fire. Well, then what would happen from that point is that once the fire agitated the monster's back or its skin enough, the monster would plummet down to the depths, and everything that was on what they thought was land, including the boat that was anchored, would be dragged all the way down into the bottom of the sea. So that's the 13th century. You fast forward to 1750s, there's a Danish bishop named Erik Pontoppidan. He describes the Kraken more as an octopus, still a tremendous size, maybe a small island, but he writes that it has a reputation for pulling down ships in a writing called The Natural History of Norway. So the Kraken is rumored to be in the Norwegian Sea, on the coast of like Iceland, Norway, Greenland, in that area. In 1850, it appears in Moby Dick. 1870, it attacks in 20,000 leagues under the sea. And so here you can see two illustrations from the book. If you're familiar with the Kraken, and if you're not a reader, you might be most familiar with the Kraken from a movie called The Pirates of the Caribbean. And in that movie, this monster would attack ships, and it would again, crush them, collapse them, and then drag them down into the bottom of the sea. I'm going to do my best audition here by reading a part of the script from Pirates of the Caribbean. Let me see if I can get into character. So the question is posed, well, why is Jack afraid of the open ocean? And the response is this: this is harder than I thought. All right, here we go. The response is this: well, if you believe such things, there's a beast that does the bidding of Davy Jones. It's a fearsome creature with giant tentacles that'll suction your face clean off, and it'll drag an entire ship down to the crushing darkness, the Kraken. They say the stench of its breath is like, ugh. Imagine the last thing you know on God's green earth is the stench of a thousand rotting corpses in this reeking odor as you're dragged down to the depths, if you believe such things. So that's Mr. Gibbs in the movie. I probably wouldn't get the part. But the Kraken, it's something that's beneath the surface. It swallows ships all. It inspires terror. It seems unstoppable. It's a monster, and it's like a harbinger of death. If you've seen the Kraken, then you know your time is at its end. And the Bible describes similar creatures, uses terms such as Leviathan, sea monsters, and dragons. And all of these terms communicate a chaos, disorder, and death. They are forces beyond human control. And so if you're following along in your note sheet, this is, I believe, the first fill-in here, that all of these creatures communicate chaos, disorder, and death. And they represent these forces that are beyond human control. So before we dive into looking at the scripture, I have two questions for us to consider. The first question is this. What do you know about what's under the water if you can't look into it? So I want us to imagine living in a world where there's no deep sea photography, there's no videography, there's no exploring the Titanic, there's no cage shark diving, there is no picture, there is no image about what's underneath the surface of the waters. In that type of world, which would be the eyes of most of human history, we would only have an understanding of what seems to skim the surface, particularly through stories of sailors, or whatever might happen to wash ashore after it dies. We don't have an idea. We don't have a look into. And I want us to imagine through the rest of our reading through the scriptures this morning that that is the world that we live in, not one where we think that we've explored most of the sea, and even still today we have not, but one where the only thing we know is from what skims the surface. And then the second question is this. When we use words, do we mean like the literal word, or do we mean the connotation of a word? So for example, if I say, you know, what is a monster? I'm asking for a definition of a monster, right? I want a literal definition. But what does it mean when we say, like, you're a monster? That he's a monster, she's a monster. Well, now we're not meaning to communicate that, if there's a Frank in the room, I'm sorry. We're not meaning to communicate that, like, Frankie is Frankenstein, right? We're not making this literal comparison, but we're saying, like, Frankie's acting in a way that is unbecoming for humans, ways that humans are not supposed to act and behave. That's what we're communicating when we say, like, you're a monster, he's a monster, or she's a monster, right? So this is part of the tension that we experience as we begin exploring the scriptures on this topic of Leviathan and sea monsters and dragons and all of these different things. So here's a Bible dictionary attempting to give Leviathan a definition. It says this: Leviathan was seen in ancient legend as a sea monster engaged in primordial warfare with the gods. This creature represented chaos in a personified manner that any creator deity had to overcome in order to create. Leviathan was also seen as a threat to the orderliness of the universe and ultimately to be subdued at the end of time. I'd love to explore this definition further, but for time's sake, we can't. If I had to guess, maybe one of your questions would be this one, though, like, is or was Leviathan a real creature? I would circle yes, and you have a yes and no on your own note sheet, and you can come to your own conclusion, and you could circle yes or no that way. If this topic today begins to interest you, there's a QR code on your note sheet, which will take you to the sermon page, and on there, you'll also see three links to Bible Project videos. You can use the QR link to click hyperlinks to those. Two are videos from the Bible Project, and one is a podcast series that is like 21 hours long. So we're obviously not going to stay here for 21 hours, right? VBS will be in less than 21 hours. But if this topic interests you, I just want to point you to those resources. It'll be well worth your time. So we're going to take a little sea monster capturing tour together throughout the scriptures. We're going to be considering the connotations of Leviathan and more. And so what are connotations. Connotations are the set of associations that are implied by a word, like in addition to its literal meaning. Right? So in addition to its literal meaning, I think Leviathan is a real creature, but Leviathan also has connotations that are associated or attached along with it being a real creature. And so hopefully that makes sense. We're going to have most of these on the screen, but we're going to read almost the whole chapter of Job chapter 41. So if you want to grab a pew Bible or open up on your phone or a Bible that you may have brought to Job 41 and just keep a bookmark in there, that's going to be where we're going to read a bulk of the scripture this morning. But we're going to start off, and I'll have the rest of these on the screen. We're going to start off in Genesis chapter 1, verse 21. So God created the great sea creatures of the sea and every living thing with which the water teems and that moves about in it according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Found this Bible here in the church. This Bible is the Revised Standard Version. It's a different translation than the New International Version, which we are reading from presently. I believe that these used to be the pew Bibles here. Not 100% certain of that. But this version phrases Genesis 1:21 a little bit differently. It says, so God created the great sea monsters, and God saw that it was good. And just for fun, as you read through some other translations, if you would look up the King James Version, the word whale is going to be inserted in this yellow section. If you look up Greek translations of the Hebraic scriptures, that Greek translation is going to use very large fish. It's very interesting. We're not going to explore all that. But what's happening here, as that definition pointed at, there's other rival stories about creation myths, how the world came into being and who orders it and how does it work. And in those myths, typically there were a multitude of gods, and some god had to have some type of war and then therefore to win and emerge out as being on top of all the others. A couple of things would happen as a byproduct of that. One of the byproducts would be through those stories, humans would then come the slaves to the victor god throughout those wars or those battles. Another thing that would happen is that often, not every time, but in a handful, so Enuma Elish is one that you could say, the Epic of Gilgamesh is another that you could read, and then there's something called the Ugaritic texts. You could read those, and in those three, there is a sea monster that needs to be defeated in order for the god who is attempting to claim their place at the top before they could do so. And so the story that we have here in Genesis, though, is that Yahweh, the creator god, creates the sea monsters, the Leviathan, if you will. He creates these things, and when they're in their appropriate place and in the appropriate way, he calls them good. Like, Yahweh doesn't have to wage some war against these to be Yahweh, the creator God. Like, our Father in heaven, the creator of the universe and everything in it, creates also these creatures and sets them in their place and calls them good. And so that's the first point on our fill-ins here, that God created the sea monsters and saw that they were good. As we continue in our tour, we're going to make our way to Job chapter 7. So we're going to stop in Job chapter 7 first. And Job is in the middle of a lament about his life. And he says this to the Lord in chapter 7, starting in verse 11. It says, therefore, I will not keep silent. I will speak out about the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea or the monster of the deep that you put me under guard? The Revised Standard Version, New Revised Standard Version says it this way. Job says, am I the sea or the dragon that you set a guard over me? Job's talking with a lot of sarcasm here, but he's saying, can you cage me and keep me quiet, God, like you do the sea monsters, the sea dragon? No, God, you're not going to keep me silent. I'm going to let out my complaints. That's Job's attitude right here in this passage. But we can see here that Job is articulating, there is an acknowledgement that God has created realms, if you will, where he has placed his creations. Like, for example, the humans on the land and dragons in the sea. And we understand how destructive water can be and how it's really not our place, right? Even still today, with all the advances that we've made, and we have water sports and boats and submarines and all these things, when floods happen with just a few inches of water, it completely destroys like all of our infrastructure. And it's just a few inches. Like when the waters leave their boundary and come crashing onto the land in the form of tsunamis and waves and a variety of things, it's just utter destruction that happens. Even still today, we're really powerless against these forces of water. So God actually responds to Job's, not just his mere complaining, but Job actually throughout the story makes some accusations against God's character. So God responds this way. This is in Job 38. We're still making our way to 41. Then the Lord spoke to Job out of the storm. He said, "Who is this that obscures my plans with words without knowledge?" I think this is so funny. "Job, brace yourself like a man, because I am going to question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me, if you understand, who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Who stretched a measuring line across it? On what were its footings set, or who laid its cornerstone? While the morning stars sang together and all the angels shouted for joy. Who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garments, its clothing, and wrapped it in thick darkness? When I fixed limits for it and set its doors and its bars in place? When I said, 'This far you may come and no farther. Here is where your proud waves halt.'" See, and I think another thing that we can understand here is that God has established boundaries for all of his creations. As we're reading through the scriptures, sea isn't just necessarily simply water. Sea also becomes this association that is implied, this connotation of chaos, of disorder, of death-like forces. It's the kind of threat, again, that is beyond human control and capacity. And so God seems to have this type of connection in mind as he continues saying to Job later on in verse 16 of chapter 38. It says, "Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me, Job, all this." See, God for the moment has contained this deathly sea. But one day he's going to remove that deathly sea from his world, his creation entirely. But if you're open in Job 41, you can begin following along with me here. God is speaking, saying this. "Can you pull in Leviathan with a fish hook or tie down its tongue with a rope? Can you put a cord through its nose or pierce its jaw with a hook? Will it keep begging you for mercy? Will it speak to you with gentle words? Will it make an agreement with you for you to take it as your slave for life? No, it will not. That is correct. Can you make a pet of it like a bird or put it on a leash for the young women in your house? Will traders barter for it? Will they divide it up amongst the merchants? Can you fill its hide with harpoons or its head with fishing spears? If you lay a hand on it, you will remember the struggle. And you will never do it again. Any hope of subduing it is false. The mere sight of it is overpowering. No one is fierce enough to rouse it. Who then is able to stand against me? Who has a claim against me that I must pay? Everything under heaven belongs to me, says the Lord. I will not fail to speak of Leviathan's limbs, its strength and its graceful form. Who can strip off its outer coat? Who can penetrate its double coat of armor? Who dares open the doors of its mouth? ringed about with fearsome teeth. It has back rows of shields tightly sealed together. Each is so close to the next that no air can pass between it. They are joined fast to one another. They cling together and cannot be parted. Its snorting throws out flashes of light. Its eyes are like the rays of dawn. Flames stream from its mouth. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke pours from its nostrils as from a boiling pot over burning reeds. Its breath sets coals ablaze, and flames dart from its mouth. Strength resides in its neck, and dismay goes before it. The folds of its flesh are tightly joined. They are firm and they are immovable. Its chest is as hard as rock, harder as a lower millstone. When it rises up, the mighty, they're terrified. They retreat before its thrashing. The sword that reaches it has no effect, nor does the spear or the dart or the javelin. Iron it treats like straw and bronze like rotten wood. Arrows do not make it flee. Sling stones are like chaff to it. A club seems to it but a little piece of straw. It laughs at the rattling of the lance. Its undersides are jagged potsherds, leaving a trail in the mud like a threshing sledge. It makes the depths churn like a boiling cauldron and stirs up the sea like a pot of ointment. It leaves glistening wake behind it. One would think the deep had white hair. Nothing on earth is its equal, a creature without fear. It looks down on all that are haughty. It is king over all that are proud. Like, the Leviathan isn't some like cute bedtime villain. This creature is pure strength and terror, impossibility. And the point here isn't that humans can tame this monster, right? The point is that God is not intimidated by the Leviathan. The strongest of the strong of humans melt before it like wax. But Yahweh, the Creator, Lord of heaven and earth, is not intimidated by the Leviathan. We're going to continue on heading into the Psalms. And in this particular Psalm, Psalm 74, the psalmist is lamenting in what seems to be God's absence about overturning one of their foes or one of their enemies. Psalm 74, start reading in verse 10. How long will the enemy mock you, God? Will the foe revile your name forever? Why do you hold back your hand, your right hand? Take it from the folds of your garment and destroy them. But God is my king from long ago. He brings salvation on the earth. It was you who split open the sea by your power. You broke the heads of the monster in the waters. It was you who crushed the heads of Leviathan and gave it as food to the creatures of the desert. Lord, you split open the seas and you brought forth dry land. The Lord did it at creation. The Lord did it again in the Exodus at the Red Sea. The Lord did it again at the Jordan River as he was leading his people into their promised land. The Lord did it two more times also at the Jordan River, specifically for the prophet Elijah and the prophet Elisha. The Lord has crushed the head of the Leviathan, as he said he would. And in this psalm, we can see a little bit of a connection. Like, God defeated the Leviathan, and he can defeat your enemy too. God crushed the heads of the Leviathan, and he can crush the heads of that foe that seems to be seeking you too. Isaiah 27, verse 1 is our next stop. Reads this. In that day, the Lord will punish with his sword, his fierce, great, and powerful sword, Leviathan, the gliding serpent, Leviathan, the coiling serpent. He will slay the monster of the sea. Well, in what day exactly, we could ask. And Isaiah, right before this, tells us. This is chapter 26, verse 19. So if you are following along, you can just look backwards. But your dead will live, Lord. Their bodies will rise. Let those who dwell in the dust wake up and shout for joy. Your dew is like that. Your dew is like the dew of the morning. The earth will give birth to her dead. In that day, the day of the resurrection life, the day when the Lord raises the dead from the earth, in that day, the Lord will punish with his sword. The New Revised Standard Version phrases Isaiah 27:1 this way: on that day, the Lord with his cruel and great and strong sword will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, Leviathan, the twisting serpent. He will kill the dragon that is in the sea. And it's here at this point in our tour that we can begin to observe Leviathan becoming somewhat synonymous with serpent and dragon. And all these terms in Isaiah 27:1 are beginning to interplay and reference together. We can begin to observe that. We're going to skip all the way back to Revelation chapter 20. And it reads this way: and I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil or Satan, and bound him. He threw him into the abyss and locked and sealed it over him. This makes me think of Jesus when he confronted some things that were tormenting a man. He came up to a man and there was a little bit of an interchange, and Jesus began to ask, you know, what is tormenting you? And the response was, legion. We are many. But when Jesus shows up, and after this interchange, there's a request by these like spiritual beings. That request to Jesus is this: please do not send us into the abyss. These beings understand Jesus has this power to send them into the abyss. So Jesus does not send them into the abyss, and then these things decide to go torment some pigs. And then these pigs make a decision to dive headstrong into waters of death anyway. It's this really kind of sounds weird and bizarre exchange about Jesus, but these things, these spiritual beings, they know who Jesus is. They know the power and authority that he holds, the authority of life and death. And so, Revelation 21, verse 1. There it is, at the bottom, sorry. Reads this way: then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. Does that mean like there's going to be no water in the new heaven and new earth? I don't think so, because there's at least a reference to river of life. But like, what happens to like all the surfers and, you know, I don't know. But this is the tension we find ourselves in between the literal meanings of words and also understanding the connotations of words, the implied associations that come along with a literal meaning. In this new heaven and new earth, there was no longer any sea. Like death, chaos, destruction, all of these things, Leviathan, dragon, serpent, they're going to be no longer in that resurrection day, that day where the earth gives up her dead, that day where where the Lord punishes with his sword this enemy and this foe who thinks that it can cross its boundaries and try to usurp what God has set in place. And so in the new creation, there is no longer any sea, no more chaos, disorder, death, destruction, threats, sea monsters, dragons, Leviathan. All that is associated with the chaotic waters is no more a part. But in the meantime, Jesus has initiated this new creation. With his death and resurrection and ascension, Jesus has initiated, he has kicked off, he has started this new creation spreading itself over the earth. When we consider Jesus, we begin to think of Jesus, and we begin to think of this theme of sea and water and disorder and destruction and terror. There's a few stories that probably come to mind, right? There's a couple of instances where the disciples find themselves on water and they're completely terrified and at their wit's end. One of them is Jesus sleeping in the bottom of a boat. Who can sleep during storms on the sea? No idea, but Jesus apparently can. And the disciples, they're losing their minds, and they wake up Jesus. Jesus, don't you care that we are going to die? And Jesus wakes up, and he corrects the winds and the waves. He rebukes the winds and the waves, and he calms the storm. And then there's another time where the disciples row on ahead of Jesus. They set out to the sea, and then Jesus, in the middle of the night, while they're caught in a storm, again, fearing for their life, Jesus comes walking on water. He is the master of the sea and everything in it. He is the master of the heavens and the earth. He is the Lord over all of creation. He's the king that commands these things. Like when Jesus shows up and begins to instruct us how to live, he doesn't want to provide like just coping strategies for how do we just maybe make it through. Like Jesus is this one who shares this authority that he has like with his people. But it's hard because we're in this middle moment. We're in this meantime, right? Where we still know the seas roar. If you will, the Leviathan, it still looms about. But in this meantime, like God still reigns. And Jesus is the one to bring that reign and rule of God, or the kingdom of God could be a phrase that we can use, here and now. Jesus is the one that calms the seas. He stills the storms. He commands the winds and the waves. He says, peace, be still. Like we think of this kraken, this massive hidden creature, and how it doesn't just like threaten, it swallows you whole. It inspires terror because it's unstoppable. It feels like it's inevitable almost. My question for us this morning is, what kraken or leviathan or sea dragon, what beast is hunting you? What seems like it has like teeth so large, that it has scales so strong, that it seems unbeatable in your life? Maybe it can be some type of oppression. Maybe it can be money pressures or job instability or substance addiction or digital addiction. Or maybe it's a family generational pattern that just seems like that you just can't shake it. Maybe it's tormenting thoughts. Maybe it's overwhelming grief. Maybe it's anxiety. Or maybe it's comparison or greed or envy. But it's something that feels like if you just let your mind go there, it swallows your life whole. Maybe it's some type of moral temptation. Maybe it's some type of sexual immorality or lust. Or maybe it's something more like gluttony. It keeps finding its way back into your life, and it latches onto you no matter what you do to try to get rid of it. Maybe it's more along the lines of just character flaws. Maybe it's name calling. Maybe it's just making fun of others. Maybe it's like scheming and deceiving and lying and try to twist circumstances so that we always get our own way. Maybe it's pride or anger. Maybe it's the things that we say on social media. I don't know, whatever it is. And I don't need to know. But if you have something that you seem that you can't shake, I want you to name it. I want you to, right now, on your Leviathan, on your sea dragon, on your monster, I want you to name it. I want you to write it down. And now that you've named it, I want you to see it for what it is. It's not something that we just want to necessarily tame and live with. It is something that is a ravenous beast that is seeking to destroy your life and my life and our lives. It's something that's bent on destruction. And here's what the Lord does with these things, right? We read through it. I don't have a sword. That would be really sweet. But the Lord takes them and he sends them into the abyss. So we're gonna sing one closing song together. And my invitation to us this morning is if you want to enter into a freedom, if you want to take a step of worship and trust towards the Lord, giving an expression that of an acknowledgement that, yes, we don't have the strength to overcome this, but Lord, I trust that you do. And Lord, I trust that you will. The invitation while we're singing this song or at the end of worship is to crunch up that Leviathan and to send it into the abyss here. And as you do, you can name it. This can be a liturgy. The liturgy is not really that important, but it could be helpful. You could name it. You could say anger and the authority of Christ. In the authority of Christ, I command you to depart from me and to find your place into the abyss. Whatever that name is, frustration and the authority of Christ, I command you to depart from me and find your place in the abyss. This will feel awkward for some of you, and I understand that. For some of you, maybe it won't. For some of you, you'll be plagued even now with, there's no way I'm walking up in front of people to throw some stupid paper into some stupid trash can. And I understand that. But there are times and moments where when we respond with our bodies to the Lord in ways, there are opportunities where he can break in and break through in the strongholds that sometimes we just allow to hang around. The Lord, as he sends out his disciples into all the globe, talks about in Mark how there is an authority that he has given to trample on snakes and serpents and to overcome all the power of the enemy. He gave that to his people, to you, to me, to us. We don't have to allow these things to continue to be sucking the life from us. We can partner with the Lord in worship. And just maybe in the meantime, he might break through in a moment. He might break through now. He might break through in the coming weeks with wisdom. I don't know. And I can't promise you exactly when and how and what it will look like. But I can promise you this, that one day the Lord will remove it. And we will be free from it. And we will find ourselves In the way of VBS here, we will find ourselves full of joy and life as we celebrate his goodness and his grace. If you don't have anything that comes to mind, I want to acknowledge that that is great. And there are seasons in life where we can feel free from these creatures that seem to be hunting us. If that's the case, I want to invite you as we sing this song. I want you to sing it as though you're singing it on behalf of and over those of us who have wrote something down and we're seeking the Lord to see it cast into the abyss.